Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You know, sometimes in the morning, I just feel...
I am a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child.
Odetta sang about a lot of things in her 77 years. Her lyrics feel like news stories these days. We lost the civil rights legend yesterday, but her voice and spirit aren't going anywhere. We're taking the long way home on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 3rd.
Good morning, Adora. Welcome back.
Thanks, John. I'm glad you noticed. I'm here. Anyhow, today we're going to take a look at what the automakers say they will do for federal aid. NATO leaders meet, and relations with Russia is high on the agenda. And the latest on Thailand. Those stories coming up, but first these headlines.
President-elect Barack Obama will soon check off another cabinet nomination. He's set to name Bill Richardson as Commerce Secretary later this morning, along with Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden. Richardson is the latest campaign rival to join the incoming administration. The big three automakers want tens of billions of dollars from taxpayers to fix their companies. Big money, but Chrysler President Jim Press claims it's cheaper than the alternative.
The cost of a bankruptcy or a loss of the U.S. manufacturing of automobiles is a far greater cost than a loan for a couple of years as a bridge of working capital to get through this tough patch.
The big three CEOs are headed to Washington. This time they've submitted detailed plans on what they'll actually do with the money.
Republicans will hang on to the hard-fought Senate seat in Georgia. Incumbent Saxby Chambliss soundly beat Democrat Jim Martin in a runoff election. Here's Chambliss.
People all around the world have truly had their eyes on Georgia. And you have delivered tonight a strong message to the world that conservative Georgia values matter.
They certainly matter to Democrats today because the win means no filibuster-proof majority in the Senate for Democrats. Some weary travelers, including many Americans, will finally get out of Thailand. The Bangkok airport is slowly getting back to business with a handful of flights going out today. Hundreds of thousands of tourists were stuck there as anti-government protests blocked flights. Protesters cleared out after a court ruling against the controversial prime minister.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in India today. She's raising the possibility of Al-Qaeda involvement in the Mumbai attacks. We're going to have more in a moment on how she's being received. The charges against Pakistan are being further elaborated today. More on that in just a moment. So are we becoming a nation of part-timers here in the United States?
Hi, my name is Tim Edgar, a musician / website developer.
So we're looking at the changing labor force. Tell us your multiple careers. Are you the actor / waitress, car dealer / coffee house barista? 877-8MYTAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org, part of our underemployment series all week on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. For the automakers, it's truth or dare, truth or consequences, deal or no deal. Well, the three CEOs of the big three from Detroit are back on Capitol Hill. And unlike the false starts of their last visit, it looks like they're getting a better reception from Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid.
We're looking to make sure that we do everything we can to take care of the auto industry. If, in fact, it's viable, that is, it's not just a rope that doesn't get them to shore.
The details of how to get the auto industry to shore financially and otherwise are being hammered out on Capitol Hill. And watching those details as the automakers look for very different bailout plans, GM, Chrysler, and Ford, are people like Bruce Thomas, who owns two Pontiac GMC dealerships down in Quincy, Florida. He joins us from his home in Florida. Bruce, you're paying a lot of attention to what's going on Capitol Hill this week, eh?
Yes, I am. I'm very interested, like many other Americans.
And I think, you know, the popular wisdom is that the auto industry will be saved when we save, you know, the factories and the management and finance the payroll and the pension for the retired workers. But what's at stake for the network of dealers such as yourself? And then I want to get into your personal story, which seems a bit harrowing as well, every bit as harrowing as any laid-off auto worker, if you ask me. Bruce?
Yeah, I think it's an untold story, really. Maybe it's starting to get out there just a little bit, but the dealers, they're probably, I think, between 19,000 and 20,000 new car dealers in the country, and a lot of us are hurting right now. Business has been down. We're affected by the crisis in Detroit just a lot more than people realize, because then we have, you know, our own employees, we have our own communities that we give to and participate in and pay taxes in and that sort of thing. And so, you know, it's really affecting us and affecting our communities.
How do you respond to the charge that was actually, talked about in some depth on Capitol Hill the last time the Big Three were up there at hearings, that the dealer network for General Motors in particular is just way too big, way too bloated, and that there's going to have to be some consolidation, even if the economy was doing well?
Well, you know, that's something that's been talked about quite a bit lately. There's probably no doubt there are too many dealers, especially the way the business has changed through the years, the number of competitors out there. The General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler network really was designed years ago when there was not as many car makes. Now there's so many. There's a dealership on every corner in a lot of towns. And so, there's probably no doubt that there's too many dealers. But that doesn't make us feel any better.
Right, sure.
When we individually own a store that may, go under.
Well, let's talk about that. It's estimated that 900 of the 20,770 or so new car dealers will go out of business this year, and that includes all of the industry. In your particular case, what is proving the most difficult for you, the two Pontiac dealerships and GMC dealership?
Well, the thing that's most difficult, I guess, is really that the drop in traffic in the new car buyer. We've just seen it just dwindle. I think it's really been slowing down for the last couple of years, but especially in the last few months, it has really dropped off. I think a lot of that is credit issues. The credit tightening has affected people. I think it's also just the attitude of the buyer right now, that nobody wants to buy. Everybody is kind of holding back, especially on big ticket items. So,
right, and you're getting it from both ends, because you got behind on payments to GMAC, which is the financing arm of General Motors, and at one point GM came in and actually took possession or took the keys to your new cars to make sure they got paid before you did on any new sales.
Yes, that's true. GMAC in our case is our what we call our floor plan provider. That's the lender for our inventory. And a lot of people don't realize that a car dealer, he's sitting out there, the average car dealer has $2 to $3 million worth of inventory in their lot, and we have to borrow money to pay for that. And so the floor plan lenders have in this country have really tightened up their lending. They've raised the rates. In some cases, they have given dealers 60 to 90 days and told them that they were going to have to find another floor plan provider.
Tough times. Thanks for joining us. Bruce Thomas is the owner of Thomas Motor Cars in Quincy, Florida. He's got two dealerships, GMC and Pontiac, down there in Quincy. Thank you very much, Bruce. Adora?
So I'm now going to go to Mumbai, where there are reports of Indians taking to the streets all over the country, and one of those is happening there in Mumbai. We go there now to find out what's going on with BBC correspondent Zubair Ahmed, who is on his way to a monument, Zubair?
Hi there. I am standing behind the Taj Mahal Hotel, the luxury hotel on the seafront, which was the scene of massacre last week, where four gunmen killed a lot of people and held scores of people hostage. And I'm standing just behind the hotel. They're not letting us get into the hotel yet. But I can see thousands of people gathering here, shouting slogans and holding placards. They are from all walks of life, but mostly young people, the Starbucks generation, the Facebook generation, they're all gathered here. And their anger is directed against the government, against the political class, against the establishment. They feel that they are not safe anymore, and these politicians have failed them because the terrorist attacks have not stopped. In the last 1 year, there have been a lot of terrorist attacks in India, and the last one happened in Mumbai, and they have come here to show their anger, to express their anger against this political class.
You describe them as the Starbucks and Facebook generation. What motivated them to come out and protest today specifically?
Basically, they were galvanized by loads of messages flying across online, across blogs and across Facebook and across all the other sites. Basically, they say that the politicians have not been able to give them security. They have not been able to protect their lives. And the political class is too soft on militants, and they want action, proper action against these people who keep attacking them. And they are saying that in the elections, the general elections, which are going to be held next year, they're saying that they're not going to vote for anybody. They're going to vote. They have this ballot on which they will vote for no candidate. That's what they're saying. They are so angry with this political class that they say that they'll not boycott the election. They will go to the polling booth, but they will not vote for any particular candidate.
And we've seen reports that these protests are taking place all over the country. Are they taking place all over the country, and are those protesters, do they have the same concerns and demands?
I'm sorry, I can't hear your question, but what I could understand that you're asking whether there have been protests elsewhere in the country. There have been protests all over the country. There have been protests ever since the attacks took place. This is not the first rally. There have been rallies. There was a rally here in Mumbai yesterday, and there have been rallies ever since the attacks happened last week. But this is indeed the biggest rally. I can see thousands and thousands of people all across the road that leading to the Taj Mahal Hotel, and they're all holding placards and they're shouting slogans against the political class, the government, and basically they're angry at all politicians, angry with all politicians, not just the ruling class, but the opposition leaders as well.
Do you think that these protests, as they continue day after day, will put pressure on the government to respond?
This has already had a little bit of an impact on the ruling class. They've been having meetings after meetings to contemplate what went wrong, where there were security lapses. They're trying to find out. And now the Prime Minister of India recently, just a few days ago, announced that there is a need for a federal police agency, just like on the lines of FBI. And they're saying that they are going to go ahead with that, but of course it has to be approved by Parliament. And the Parliament will be, the term of the Parliament will be over by March next year.
Zubair Ahmed, thank you so much. Zubair Ahmed is a BBC correspondent, and he was coming to us from Mumbai, where there are currently protests happening against the government.
Two governments, Pakistan and in India, under siege there. India facing an election next year. That's only going to escalate.
And that's what they want. The protesters say you better react to our demands now, otherwise you will face those consequences when the elections come up next year.
Strong rhetoric, two weak governments. It's certainly going to be one of the first jobs for Barack Obama when he takes office in January in South Asia.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. Are we becoming a nation of part-timers? It's just one of the questions we're looking at this week as we look at the changing labor force. We want to hear about your multiple career lifestyle.
Hi, this is Daniel from Brooklyn. The past 8 years I've been a filmmaker slash investor, but recently needed to add another slash. So I'm now currently enrolled in law school, and so I'll then be a filmmaker slash investor slash lawyer.
Slash
there you
student.
Go.
Slash
Three.
Student.
Right. Slash right. student. We want to know, have you moved into two or more part-time careers because you really have no choice? Tell us your slash at 877-8-MYTAKE or MYTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
So between now and the election of Barack Obama, we're looking at something that, for lack of a better word, we're calling low-hanging change fruit. There's a lot of change that could happen because in really the generation or so since the Cold War ended, a lot of things are outmoded and obsolete in this world. Say the embargo in Cuba, the DMZ in Korea, demilitarized zone. NATO, of course, is another one of these leftovers from the end of World War II, and its identity and mission is really changing in this century, despite its expansion. And NATO foreign ministers, while looking forward to the 21st century, are also looking back to the Cold War. They've agreed to reopen the alliance's dialogue with Russia, broken off in the wake of Moscow's invasion of Georgia last summer. NATO has also agreed to press ahead in helping Georgia and Ukraine prepare for eventual NATO membership. So to talk about this meeting and the mission of NATO, we spoke with BBC diplomatic correspondent Jonathan Marcus, who was in the middle of it all from NATO headquarters in Brussels.
Yes, hi there. Thank you.
You know, NATO has a lot on its plate. It definitely has to consider reopening this dialogue because the Georgia crisis was a very interesting indicator of things to come in this century. But NATO's also looking broadly ahead before Barack Obama takes office at its mission going forward. How are those things playing at this meeting?
Well, all of them have been touched on, and there's been a bit of a review of activities in Afghanistan, of course, operations elsewhere, still in the Balkans, and there are NATO warships obviously engaged in anti-piracy operations at the moment as well. But also much talk on the political front, looking at the future expansion of the alliance, decisions taken here today to develop a whole new reform program for Georgia and Ukraine that will keep them on the path towards possibly eventual NATO membership. Also, as you're pointing out, a decision to renew in a graduated and cautious way the dialogue with Russia. That, of course, was broken off after Russia's invasion of Georgia in the summer. Many NATO members are really wanting, I think, perhaps a rather more root and branch reassessment of ties with Russia, but the consensus view prevailed. There will be this cautious attempt to explore a restarting of contacts over the coming weeks and months.
There's one view that NATO's mission in opening a dialogue with Russia is one essentially of containment, that basically you stay there, we're over here, and we're going to try to get as many, you know, former satellite countries or former Soviet republics in NATO as we possibly can. There's also a view in Europe that no, NATO's mission should be cooperation, development of bilateral and multilateral ties between Russia and Europe. Is there any consensus as this meeting goes forward?
I think you're pointing to an area of important differences, and I think differences that are perhaps going to continue even into an Obama presidency. I think the problem is this, that in the wake of the Cold War, NATO tried very hard to bring Russia around, if you like, to make it part of a broader system of international relations in Europe. This was very much what Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice was talking about yesterday. She said that a lot had been done to try and bring the Russians round, but that all of that had been done on the basis that the 19th century, as she put it, was over, and that Russia would behave like a responsible player, not bullying its neighbours and so on. Now, the events in the summer in Georgia with Russia's invasion are really focus minds here, but they focus minds in really rather different directions. Some countries, the United States, of course, but also some of the newer European members of the alliance, Poland, the Baltic republics and so on, now very concerned about a potential resurgent military threat from Russia. And the Russians have threatened to target missiles on Poland if the US missile defense scheme goes ahead and so on. So that's one response. The response of some of the older European member of the alliance, and you know, you're kind of thinking back here to the distinction made by former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld,
like old
Europe,
yeah,
France,
sure.
Germany,
yeah.
And so on. They're concerned about the Russian rhetoric. They don't see particularly a military threat, and they stress the need to engage with Russia, because of course Russia is an important economic player, and no more so than in the field of energy, and Europe is very tied into Russia in energy terms. So divisions within the alliance on Russia papered over here, but I think divisions that are going to continue in the months ahead.
Given that complicated soup that you've just laid out, Jonathan, is there any discussion as to whether or not NATO is relevant and what its purpose is?
Well, the trouble is, I think it has different purposes for different members. I mean, as one senior NATO official put it to me, the kind of glue that used to hold the alliance together, which really was the Soviet threat, has disappeared. The resurgent Russian threat, if you want to call it that, is not uniting the alliance. It's, as I just explained, dividing it. There are divisions about NATO as a kind of adjunct to America's global policing role. There are divisions about the fundamental importance to the alliance of the mission in Afghanistan. You know, these are all things which don't come up in the communiques, which kind of pour a rather sort of ecumenical balm over all of these divisions. And I suppose that's the business of diplomats, to write communiques that make everything sound hunky-dory and okay. But in reality, there are lots and lots of divisions. You know, fundamentally, for some NATO members, the alliance is as important as ever. For some of them, it's probably less important. And,
well, at the,
that
the
makes
very,
things very difficult.
At the very least, Jonathan, there will be pressure on the Obama administration as it takes office to maybe think about reversing what Bill Clinton did when he took office in 92, which was begin a process of NATO expansion. Maybe NATO contraction or NATO sort of plateauing would be the key to this new administration. Jonathan Marcus, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Marcus is a correspondent with our partner, the BBC. He joined us from NATO headquarters there.
Fascinating questions and yes. Big questions about how the world orders itself, and we'll see what happens.
Now is NATO relevant? Is NATO relevant? Femi Oke is here with the headlines. I don't know if it's a headline. Is NATO relevant?
Is NATO relevant? That's a question to be
That's
answered.
A question. By
later
us.
Later notice, yes.
You can work on that.
You can answer your own question while I do the news, okay? 29 minutes past the hour. Good morning. Conservative Georgia values matter. That's what Saxby Chambliss said last night in his victory speech in a runoff Senate election. He beat Democratic challenger Jim Martin soundly, and that means there will be no filibuster-proof majority for the Democrats. A key opponent of Hugo Chavez is facing corruption charges. Venezuelan prosecutors have summoned Manuel Rosales to appear before a judge next week. Rosales has denied the allegations. The divorce rate among active duty soldiers is up. It increased 0.2% in the Army in 2008, and that's according to the Department of Defense. And the figures are also up for divorce in the Marines as well. And the South Bend Tribune is reporting that football coach Charlie Weiss will return for another season at Notre Dame. And Weiss has 7 years left on his multi-million dollar contract.
The toughest job in sports, coach of Notre Dame. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. As the economy continues to falter, more and more states are finding it very tough. 43 states now are operating with a deficit, facing billions in budget shortfalls. Governors and state legislators worried about potentially draconian steps to keep their states running and comply with legally mandated balanced budgets are turning to the federal government for help. Joining us to describe the requests and how they would work is President of the National Conference of State Legislatures, Joe Hackney, who's also the Speaker of the North Carolina State House. He's also a cattleman with a family farm. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning.
So I've read that altogether states could face up to $200 billion in deficits. Practically, what does this mean for people who live in those states?
Well, we don't know exactly how high the figure will go. That's our last estimate was actually around 140. About 50 of that has already been cut last fiscal year and this because of declining revenues. But what it means is that education is one of the biggest expenses in most of our states. Medicaid, which is a partnership with the federal government, is also a large expense. Safety net programs are likely to be affected. And, of course, our infrastructure, progress on the infrastructure funding is at risk. So I think what the legislatures around America and the governors are saying is we're going to have a stimulus package.
Mm-hmm.
Let's kill two birds with one stone. Let's make it a win-win and use that stimulus money to put it on the ground quickly for extending unemployment compensation, for food stamps, to assist the states with Medicaid and with infrastructure.
The National Conference of State Legislators, you met this week. President-elect Obama came and spoke. Did he say what you wanted to hear?
Well, he actually spoke to the NGA, the Governors Association, but the reports I have, he very much is on board with some sort of stimulus package to assist the states. The details are yet to be worked out, and, of course, the Congress we're talking with the Congress as well. We believe it probably will happen.
And so what would your request be? How could the federal government effectively assist 43 different states with different issues?
Well, certainly with infrastructure. We all have, because of declining petroleum use, all of us are suffering a decline in our gas tax revenues. We have bridges that are deficient. We have paving projects that are on hold. All of those put jobs on the ground right away. We have paving contractors in my state who are not at full employment, not anywhere near it. Transit projects, water and sewer projects, all of those are things that need to be done. Some of them are critical, and yet the states don't have the money to do it. What better win-win could we create than to use stimulus money to do something that needs to be done anyway? Likewise, with a third extension of unemployment compensation benefits,
mm-hmm.
puts money into the pockets of those who need it the worst. Same thing with food stamps and with Medicaid.
You mentioned the National Association of Governors meeting. Not all governors are on board for some kind of federal bailout. Let's listen to what South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford said.
We've been told for a long number of months that this stimulus would turn the economy around, and it hadn't. We were told that with the first issue of tax rebates of about $150 billion in size. Then it grew to about $2.3 trillion in size. Bloomberg now reports we're about $7 trillion in size in terms of stimulus. And so I think that there are very legitimate questions by any number of different folks, both represented in this group and certainly outside this room across America, on whether or not this will indeed make the difference.
What's your response to that?
Well, I think the governor doesn't believe in stimulus packages. And that puts him in a distinct minority among the economists across America. Most of the economists and the political folks as well, both in the legislatures and among the governors, I think the consensus is very much that we do need a sizable stimulus package. The states cannot, with balanced budget requirements, cannot ramp up their spending in times of declining revenues. It falls to the federal government to fill that role. And I think most people, including obviously the current president and the president-elect and most members of the Congress, feel that our economy needs that stimulus.
Joe, let me just ask one question of elaboration, though. I mean, if you have deficits and tax shortfalls, a stimulus package isn't necessarily going to help you with those. It will maybe fix some bridges, but you're still going to have to collect the more taxes to save that. How would you direct the money from the federal government? Does it go in your general fund? Is it earmarked for specific bridges? Do you want total control over this federal revenue sharing? How do you think that's going to work best for you?
We're not asking to put it in our general fund. We're asking for it to stimulate the economy in our states. We'll worry about our general fund. We'll balance our budgets. We'll get through. We always do. But stimulus money stimulates spending in the states. It puts people to work, and work creates tax revenues to bring our states back. So the tax revenues will begin to come back when people get back to work, when people are buying goods and services. And so the point of it all is the stimulus. And to use the money for something that puts money on the ground and people to work right away does, in fact, create new and additional state revenues.
Thanks for joining us, Joe. Joe Hackney is the president of the National Conference of State Legislatures and speaker of the North Carolina State House, and he was giving us his argument for why a stimulus package should include money for infrastructure. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines of the morning. Good morning, Femi.
Good morning to you, Adora. We are getting some reports from Mumbai that there may be some explosives discovered there. I will get some more details for you. We're just beginning to get the information. Police say that they have found explosive hidden in a bag in Mumbai's main train station. More news on that story as we get it. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in the Indian capital of New Delhi. She's there to express her condolences for last week's terrorist attacks in Mumbai. And India says the attackers had links to Pakistan. Bada, Pakistani President Asif Ali Zardari says that any terrorist suspects in Pakistan should be tried there. India demanded yesterday that Pakistan hand over 20 terrorist suspects, including India's most wanted man. President-elect Barack Obama will name another cabinet position today. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson is expected to be Commerce Secretary for the new administration. And a quick correction from me. I mentioned earlier that the South Bend Tribune is reporting that football coach Charlie Weiss will return for another season at Notre Dame. Now, of course, what I should have said was that he's returning to Notre Dame, and Weiss has a seven
Notre Dame, come on, what's
Dame.
Wrong with you?
How do you get
Where
Notre
you
Dame out of Notre Dame, for goodness sake?
Thanks, Femi.
Yeah.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. And call it a cleanup or a festive atmosphere, but the situation in Bangkok, Thailand, has improved significantly. Commercial flights are taking off and landing there. And we spoke earlier to BBC correspondent in Asia, John Sudworth, who joined us from Bangkok. And at the time we spoke with him, he was sorting things out. Actually, it seemed like he was contributing to the end of this chaotic, crazy scene.
Well, I'm not sure how much influence I have, although having said that, I turned up and the whole thing seems to have come to some sort of an end.
Good for you. That's
yeah,
what we like.
Perhaps they should think of dispatching me to Afghanistan next. Basically, the siege has ended. The airport is now cleared of protesters. They've rolled up their sleeping mats and left. to be replaced by an army of cleaners who've spent the day with buckets and mops. And I have to say, it's beginning to look like the state-of-the-art transport hub that it once was. The first flight in was a domestic flight in from the resort of Phuket. That landed just a few hours after the protesters had gone. But international flights are resuming this evening. Thai Airways hopes to get 5 or 6 flights out. Its flight to Sydney should have already left. So there's a real feeling that things will begin now to swiftly return to normal. And the airport authorities are saying they could have the whole thing back up and running, providing a full service by Friday.
Well, a comfort to the 300,000 people who were stranded, many of them unable to get home for Thanksgiving holidays in the United States. And I gather with all the cleanup, some of those Christmas decorations they were putting up last week are looking a little less forlorn. John, we should remind people that this protest was the culmination of a standoff between the government and anti-government protesters that has gone on since August and escalated into a regional crisis. Describe but where it goes from here.
Well, that's right. This is a crippling political stalemate. Thailand may have its international airport back, but if anything, the events of the past week have only deepened the political and social divide here. This is more than just a run-of-the-mill political tiff that has held up these thousands of international travellers. They've been delayed by what has been described by many as a full-blown class war, a battle for the heart and soul of Thailand's democracy, if you like. The people who are occupying the airport in many ways can be said to be drawn largely from the Thai middle class. They are people with allegiances to the old centres of power, the military and the monarchy. And on the other side, we have the armies of rural poor, the supporters of the governing parties at the moment, allied to the former ousted Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. And it's really the political stalemate between these two groups that have brought us to where we are.
It's essentially a kind of class warfare tinged with the history of the monarchy. The next scene in this drama is, and before we go, the next prime minister or the next government that's going to be named. Any sign of what that will be?
Well, that's exactly right. And that's the real concern, that essentially the political parties that have been disbanded as a result of yesterday's Constitutional Court decision simply plan to regroup under a new name and elect a new leader on Monday. No word yet as to who that will be. It will be Thailand's third prime minister in as many months.
Wow.
But the protesters are saying that if they don't like that choice, they could return to their protests. And there's the possibility of more civil unrest.
Well, John Sudworth will be staying there to keep things calm. John Sudworth is a BBC correspondent in Asia. He joined us from Bangkok, where flights took off today from Bangkok International Airport.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 3rd, and Femi Okeh has just joined us. She's got the latest headlines.
Good morning to you. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The big three automaker CEOs will be on Capitol Hill later this week. And this time they've brought detailed plans on how they use tens of billions in taxpayer dollars. Skeptical lawmakers are reviewing the carmakers' proposals for fixing their businesses. Riot police clash with protesters in Zimbabwe's capital today. The demonstrators were mostly doctors and nurses protesting the country's health crisis. A cholera epidemic has killed hundreds and anthrax has spread to humans. President Bush has been looking back on his 8 years in office in a long interview with ABC News' Charlie Gibson. In part two of his interview last night, the president talked about his major disappointments during his tenure.
Well, I mentioned one, and that is no weapons of mass destruction. I think another in Iraq, I think another great disappointment was not getting immigration reform done. I firmly believe that the immigration debate really didn't show the true nature of America as a welcoming society.
And that's President Bush talking to Charlie Gibson on ABC last night, talking about his 8 years in office. I'm getting more details in now from the Associated Press, who are reporting that police in Mumbai, India, have found diffused explosives hidden in a bag in Mumbai's main train station, which they said was left over from last week's attacks. Senior police officer Rakesh Maria says that the bag was found as police officials were going through abandoned luggage today. As far as the markets are concerned, we are looking at a mixed bag this morning. The Asian markets largely closed up. European markets are moving now and have largely been down today. Futures trading shows that Wall Street traders betting on a lower opening later this morning. Let's look at some big stories making news for you today.
Thanks very much, Femi. We have a question for you today, and that is, are we becoming a nation of part-timers? All week, we're looking at the changing labor force, and we want to hear your stories.
I have such a blessed and fulfilling slash life. I am a moil slash sound engineer slash scientist slash physician. Actually, maybe somebody that's a moil and a surgeon shouldn't use slash.
That's great.
That is good. So we want to hear your story of your multiple careers, perhaps simultaneously. 8778-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
You are a slash this, a slash that. People's multiple careers are more and more defining them, not only because of a changing technological environment, because of this changing economic environment. And we're here to talk more about the world of multiple career personalities as part of our underemployment series on The Takeaway all week. It's Marcy Albaher. She's the author of One Person, Multiple Careers. And until recently, she was the blogger behind the New York Times blog, Shifting Careers. And we asked her to come in this morning. Welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
There's
Thank you.
So much to talk to you about. People do describe themselves, first of all, and let's just get the smiley face part of the story first. People do describe themselves as having different skills, different occupations. It's no longer, I'm just a guy who works for IBM, right?
Right. Well, it's funny because I think my book came out in 2007, spring of 2007, and when I wrote that book, I was kind of, my whole position was, this is a fulfilling way to work. This is this idea of we need balance in our lives. Some of us have left brain and right brain talents, or we're artists as well as business people,
entrepreneurs,
right? Exactly. Yeah. And we have many dimensions to
innovators,
our lives.
Innovators, yeah.
And the people that I profiled were people who were living like that, who were building slash careers to engage themselves more fully in the world, to not limit themselves in these singular ways of defining themselves.
It's suddenly gotten
and
real.
Suddenly it's become a slashing for security, slashing as a really practical way to live. And all these people who are already on the bandwagon of thinking it's a really good idea to have multiple streams of income, multiple ways to make a living, multiple talents that you know how to commercialize, all those people are feeling pretty more confident now, and my whole point was this is not something you should that you know being a Renaissance person is something you should flaunt, not hide, and many people agree with me, but there's still lots of people who aren't thinking this way, who are used to their one employer taking care of them forever.
And there are plenty of people who are going to be forced into this situation.
Exactly.
In the last month, 675,000 people were forced out of full-time employment into part-time employment.
Right.
It's estimated that if you add the part-timers, people who for economic reasons are working part-time, into the overall unemployment figures, you get a figure of 12.3 million, something like 12% at least, 12% of the workforce is underemployed.
Right.
So how do you turn that kind of sad story where
right.
you're compelled to move into a situation where you often don't have benefits
right.
into something good?
Right. So, you know, I was talking about slashing by choice, and this is now slashing by necessity, right? So I think, and here I'll tell you, I'm a perfect example of this. So as I've been on this show many times in the last few months, and I was always described as the blogger for the New York Times Shifting Careers
right.
blog, which
right.
is a blog I created to talk about these ideas
right.
at the Times. And about a month and a half ago, I learned that through budget cuts, the Times was cutting my blog, which was quite popular. They said it had nothing to do with performance, that this was a budgetary cut. They're still keeping me on to do other work. I still write a Shifting Careers column, which is much more occasional. It's in the paper. It's not online.
But, so you're writer slash freelancer.
Right. Well, I've always been a freelancer.
Right.
So they didn't cut. I was an employee. I was never getting my health insurance from the Times. I always got my health insurance through a Writers Trade Association
right.
because I live like freelancer. But in the last year, I had allowed the Times to become a big part of my portfolio. I mean, I was giving them at least 50 to 60% of my time. And there were months where they asked for more. You know, would you do this? Would you do that? All at extra pay. But I was putting a lot of eggs in one basket. And as a freelancer, that's something I had never really wanted to do. I like to diversify my portfolio.
The single client syndrome can do you in.
And when you're doing really well with one client, they want to throw more work at you. They know you're reliable. They know you're available. So you understand their systems. Mm-hmm. But I made a real strong point to keep up my other slashes while I was doing that. And they're all consistent with being a journalist. As a journalist, we have to be careful. We can't do all kinds. Some certain kinds of slashes are not compatible with being a journalist. But I teach journalism. I privately coach other writers. I do public speaking. And those things, I never stopped doing them. And I always wrote for other publications as well and maintain relationships with other editors.
Mm-hmm. What if you're starting from scratch, though? Right. What if you have been working for a single employer, and let's say it's a blue-collar job?
Mm-hmm.
Do you start trying to reorganize the whole way that you look at working?
Well, I think the first thing you would do is you're going to have some time on your hands. And I think how you use that time is really critical. And the first suggestion I would say is to figure out some way to get some retraining in something mm-hmm. else. And I say something else because maybe there's something you already have a knack in, something you're really good at that everybody has always said, gee, John, you know, you're really good at, you know, teaching people how to cook. I don't know, you know, and maybe
actually,
you should.
I am.
Okay. Yes. So yeah.
So he says we've never seen the proof
yeah, well,
of that.
So, you know. My skeptical co-host. I haven't food poisoned
so
her yet.
Could you take that to the next level?
Yeah,
could you start offering some cooking classes in your community to try to build a brand around that? Or, I mean, it's going to be very, very different for each person, but I would think really strongly about re-education, and I like nothing more than when I hear Obama talk about this, you know, 5 million green-collar jobs coming up. I mean, I think we're going to have to figure out how to help people who need retraining because their industries are going away.
Well, Marcy, one of the things you write that's so great that relates to this blue-collar point is for a lot of people, there's a giant psychological threshold of going from full-time auto worker, for instance, to dog walker.
Right.
And if you make your decision to do the dog walking along with, and I'm going to be going to school to retrain, it takes some of the edge off of the sort of feeling like you've come down a few notches if you take training along with one of these jobs that seems humiliating.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I was really trying to encourage people whenever I talk to people about thinking about this new model is try to find something that is both income generating and interesting to you. Like, try to really work towards this process. And there are some great books out there, and not just mine, but I write about. If you go to the blog, there's a huge archive of books, and there's a lot of ways to inexpensively start to explore your passions, your interest, and see if any of them happen to be the kinds of things that might be something you can turn into something else. But I think you're right, John. Like, the combination of doing different things at once can take some of the sting out of it. And education is really stimulating. Like, people find that when they go to learn something else, they usually some part of their brain lights up. Like, it is a good experience for people. And they connect with other people who are also learning something new.
It's a social thing. Exactly.
Social gets you out.
It's a social network. Yeah. So serve up some education with your career survival. Marcy, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure.
Marcy Albahar is the author of the book One Person, Multiple Careers, and she's the writer behind the blog HeyMarcy.com.
And Marcy told us her story about being a part-timer, and Sam on our website told us his. He says, as a former college professor making a transition to a small business entrepreneur, I am in the process of building a business school for myself to learn everything I need to create business opportunities. I am both a student and professor in this school. In the near future, I will open my school to the public and make itself a business opportunity. So there you go.
What are your slashes? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're looking at multiple careers in an environment of underemployment in America. 12% of the labor force is either unemployed or underemployed. And that means we're always on at The Takeaway.
And we'll be talking about that for the rest of this week. But for now, here's your takeaway.
Being a Renaissance person is something you should flaunt, not hide. And many people agree with me, but there's still lots of people who aren't thinking this way, who are used to their one employer taking care of them.
That's Marcy Albahar, and you can reach her website at Marcy, M-A-R-C-I, HeyMarcy.com. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Come on, everybody, let's get going.
If you can't fly, Run, you can run. Walk, and if you can't walk, crawl. Any way you make it, baby, you keep on moving on.
Any way they can, Americans are coping with a changing economy. Finding a second or third life is proving a challenge, whether you're a car company, an airline, or a home business. Underemployment, keeping your life afloat. And saying goodbye to folk singing legend Odetta.
Sitting down singing my songs. I sing to find the spirit. I keep it up bright and strong.
She's any singing us out on The Takeaway.
Make it, baby, you keep on to move it on. And if you...
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 3rd, and what a good message, John.
Yeah,
just keep on moving on, a universal theme there.
77 years old. Good morning, Adora.
77 years old, young. Today, major concessions from the automakers hoping to get federal aid. Also, big questions about the health of the airline industry and Cuba-U.S. relations. A look at how they stand today. Those stories are coming up. First, these headlines.
Bill Richardson is set to be the next member of the Obama cabinet. The president-elect is scheduled to nominate the New Mexico governor as Commerce Secretary later this morning. Richardson has plenty of experience working for the White House. He was Energy Secretary and U.N. Ambassador in the Clinton administration. After a tough year, Republicans actually have something to celebrate today. Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss beat Democrat Jim Martin in a runoff election by a strong margin. Chambliss used his victory speech to look forward.
This race truly is the first race of 2010. And we've got some work to do as Republicans in rebuilding our party, and we're going to do it.
This officially kills off Democratic hopes for a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. More on the significance of the Georgia race in just a moment.
Overseas in Mumbai, police say they've found and defused a bag of explosives at the main train station. They say they were left over from last week's attacks. The train station was one of the first targets. Today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in India to offer American assistance. The CEOs of the three automakers back here at home in Washington, they'll be talking again in front of a panel, begging for tens of billions from Congress. Lawmakers are reviewing their proposals. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi wants them also to look forward.
The industry must show how it will innovate and prepare to take the companies into the 21st century. It's about viability of the industry. It's about accountability to the taxpayer. And it's about innovation for the future.
As for accountability, this time the CEOs are driving to D.C. to avoid getting nailed for taking private jets as they did last month. It's about a 9-hour ride, so The Takeaway recommends a brief stopover in Pennsylvania, where auto chiefs can fortify body and mind with a delicious plate of Scrapple.
And recommendation from our news writer, Mark Garrison. So are we becoming a nation of part-timers like Mark Garrison will be after this newscast? All week we are looking at the changing labor force. Tell us your multiple careers.
I'm a system mechanic operator for utility company during the day. Then during the night, I'm a server.
Tell us your slash at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Mark, everything's okay.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
There's certain standards that we want to see. We want to see a commitment to the future. We want to see a restructuring of their approach, that they have a new business model, a new business plan. There has to be a compensation reform.
That's Democratic Speaker of the House of Representatives Nancy Pelosi speaking yesterday with a laundry list of demands that Congress has from the big three automakers to agree to some kind of a bailout situation. The big three CEOs are back on Capitol Hill in hearings that begin tomorrow to talk about the details of bailing them out. And they're getting a much warmer reception. In the details of the plans and the business health of these companies, we're learning a lot about the state of the industry. And we're learning that Congress is actually a little more warm to the auto industry than was the case the last time. Joining us now is David Herzenhorn from our partner, The New York Times, with the details. David, thanks for being a part of the program.
Thanks, Jeff.
So you are looking at these details getting hammered out. Let's start at the top. First of all, it's very, very clear that the big three are the big one plus the two not necessarily very healthy automakers. Let's describe what that looks like at this point.
Well, let's start with the important stuff, right? These fat cat CEOs are road tripping it from Detroit to Washington,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
That's the crucial thing in a Chevy Malibu and a Ford Escape.
But David, here's a question. I wonder if Alan Mulally knows what side the gas tank is when he stops for gas. Is he going to know which side the gas tank is on his, you know, Ford Escort or whatever he's driving?
He knows because he decided. He made, you know, it's a crucial engineering decision that went all the way to the top.
You say so. Okay.
So, look, these, you know, there's all sorts of maneuvering going on Capitol Hill, and the big theater will really come on Thursday and Friday when the auto executives are back in front of committees for hearings again. Here's the challenge for Nancy Pelosi. Congress has demanded plans. The car manufacturers have come back with the plans. The plans call for massive cost cutting and the elimination of thousands of jobs. So who might get blamed for that?
Right.
It's there's no choice, but you start to realize what a no-win situation this has become.
I mean, David, it's a clearly dire situation. I guess what I'm wondering is, boy, these automakers sure did come up with a plan in a very short period of time. I mean, they were just on Capitol Hill a couple of weeks ago asking for the money when they were sent home to come up with something, and they've laid out very specific changes that they can make. Why not before?
There was some miscalculation on both sides in terms of what the politics were. You know, part of this is fallout from the $700 billion Treasury program and the legislative fight that happened in September, where you have, you know, bailout is now a four-letter word on Capitol Hill. There is just not a lot of appetite among lawmakers in either party. Plus, you've got the lame duck, the problem of a lame duck session, where everything is more complicated. And really, they sort of underestimated how hard it would be to sell the idea of a government rescue for the auto industry, even to lawmakers who were traditionally supporters of the big three car makers. So, I have colleagues who have a great story today out of Michigan who say even in that state, it's so dependent on the industry, there isn't sort of universal agreement that this is the right way to go. The taxpayer should be on the hook here.
Well, the clock is ticking, and the urgency is greatest for GM, which needs $18 billion, maybe less so for Chrysler, which needs $7 billion. And Ford yesterday said, kind of out of the blue, we actually don't need any money. We have a credit line. We can get through this period, but we, you know, maybe want some sort of assistance in innovation from the federal government. It's looking much less dire in terms of survival of these companies, even if the details aren't worked out.
Well, GM is clearly in trouble. And look, the other twist is that the conversation had been about some sort of $25 billion package. Now these requests total in at $34 billion. I mean, it's sort of unclear. I'm not sure that we have as much clarity. I mean, the plans are detailed, but we still don't have an idea of how Congress and the White House, the Bush White House, are going to agree on where to take the money from, what the terms would be. I think there's a lot that's still up in the air. Actually.
Well, as that takes form on Thursday and Friday, we'll be talking to you again. David Herzenhorn is Washington Bureau for the New York Times, talking to us about the auto bailout plans and the details being hammered out on Capitol Hill.
Great to be with you, David.
Sure.
We're going to stay with politics and move to Georgia, where the race for the Senate seat there has finally been settled. Republican incumbent Saxby Chambliss handily won and ended Democratic hopes to reach a 60-seat filibuster-proof majority in the Senate.
People all around the world have truly had their eyes on Georgia. And you have delivered tonight a strong message to the world that conservative Georgia values matter.
Susanna Capiluto of Georgia Public Broadcasting joins us now with a wrap-up. Good morning and welcome back, Susanna.
Good morning.
So the senator there, he won handily. It was not close at all, although some predicted it would be. What happened?
Well, what happened is that basically young people didn't go out to vote. African Americans didn't go to the polls. And Republicans did because they really had something to vote for. Democrats would just go as a favor maybe to Barack Obama, which was kind of the narrative here. And basically Jim Martin, in this runoff, tried everything. I mean, he even on Monday when Sarah Palin came here, I mean, the media kind of thought, hey, this is in the bag with Sarah Palin's appearance. But to try to top that, Jim Martin, the Democrat, appeared with T.I. and Ludacris. And there's this picture of this out-of-place older white man with these two rappers, you know, basically saying, go out and vote. And I think every young person looks at that and say, I know this isn't real. This guy doesn't know the difference between a T.I. tune and a Ludacris tune. So they were really trying to pull out all the stops, but it just wasn't enough. And it was always a long shot. They knew that. And I think that's what happened. And Republicans, on the other hand, they knew they had to save their party. And there's a lot to be said about this checks and balances. People like checks and balances in Georgia, I think, in general, and they are conservative. And I wanted to mention to you that from now on, Saxby Chambliss will be known as 41. That's
That was so funny.
We no longer refer to him as Saxby Chambliss. It's 41.
Right. referring to the fact that he's a 41st Republican in the Senate, holding back the Democratic filibuster majority. But why do you think the turnout was so low? During the presidential election, Georgia had a solid turnout.
Right, and that was very exciting for Georgia Democrats because finally they realized, hey, we're like on the tipping point. I mean, of all the red states other than Montana, I think Georgia is like almost blue. You know, it wasn't that big of a margin of all the red states. We could be blue in 2 years, maybe, but Democrats here have to figure out, you know, how to get their African American base folded into the party. And having Barack Obama on the ballot, they had something to vote for. They wanted Barack Obama. That buoyed Martin into this runoff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the runoff, people, Martin, who is this guy? You know, I mean, while he is known, but it's kind of like, okay.
So he was an afterthought.
Very much.
He was certainly
I think they said there was like 80,000 people didn't even go down the ballot. They just voted for Obama. That was it. Mm. If they had gone down the ballot and just, oh, here's another Democrat, you know, he might not even, you know, it might have been an easier win for him.
Susanna, you know, that song Almost Blue is a great Elvis Costello song, by the way, you know, since we're talking about Ludacris and pop
yes.
music and everything. A high-stakes game for Jim Martin, though. If you're going to bring Ludacris in, you're going to end up looking ludicrous if it doesn't do anything. Sarah Palin wins, though, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
She moved the needle.
Well, I don't know if she really moved the needle. I think she kind of reiterated the needle. I think the whole narrative through these 4 weeks was they hammered this fact home to Republicans. You got to hold the line for this party or Barack Obama and his liberal agenda will just run through Washington. And that was hammered in messages. I mean, some people said, you know, the ads that were running were a lot of issue ads still. I mean, Jim Martin was trying to, you know, hold the line. He spent a lot on ads. On one way, you know, I talked to some of his party people last night and they were basically saying, we think we did everything. We didn't do any major mess-ups. And they didn't. It's basically just him as a person. You know, there wasn't anything to vote for. He's a very nice guy. He's very sincere. But it just didn't excite anyone. But Chambliss could have been Santa Claus, and he could have won.
He could have won.
Because it was the Republican Party.
And the Republicans did well in Georgia. Susanna Capiluto, news director of Georgia Public Broadcasting. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So have you noticed we're becoming a nation of part-timers? All week we're looking at the changing labor force. Tell us your slash.
Hi, I'm Bob from New Jersey. I'm a part-time financial office manager and a part-time tennis instructor. And I do a couple of volunteer jobs, and I'm up to my neck in stuff.
That's cab driver slash financial analyst. Are you a milkman in the morning and a club DJ at night? That sounds good. I think I'm moving to some of that action. Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're serious. It's part of our underemployment week here.
And let's see if you can beat that milkman in the morning and DJ at night. We want to hear your story, 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Milkman at night. That'd be interesting.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Joe from Bellingham, Mass., unemployed architect liquor store clerk. Just got to make some money on top of unemployment. And hopefully by the beginning of the year, I'll have another job.
Tell us your multiple careers. Are you a junior executive / Bible historian, musician / quantum mechanic? What multiple work personalities are you taking on in this economic environment? It's a serious story about our underemployment series. 877-8-MY-TAKE for your stories, or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Overseas now, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in India, and she expressed solidarity with Indian leaders following the militant attacks in Mumbai last week. Rice described the multiple attacks as, quote, the kind of terror in which Al-Qaeda participates. BBC correspondent Chris Morris is following developments, and he joins us from Delhi.
Morning.
So who is Dr. Rice consulting with, and what are her aims for this trip?
Well, she's meeting all of India's top leaders, the Prime Minister, the Foreign Minister, the National Security Advisor. But beyond that, I think she wants to send a message to everyone in India. She said, my principal aim on arriving here is to express U.S. solidarity with the people of India. She knows that six Americans died in the attacks in Mumbai last week, but she also knows that the vast majority of those who were killed were ordinary Indians. And she knows that India has experienced a spate of terrorist attacks this year, but none quite like this one. And so I think that's her primary aim, to say publicly, we're standing with you. Then, of course, there's all the negotiation behind the scenes, asking India not to be too aggressive towards Pakistan, but at the same time trying to support India's demand that Pakistan hand over and cooperate with finding any suspects who are proven to be behind this attack. So it's quite a difficult balancing act for her to follow.
Let's talk about the India-Pakistan relationship in a moment. But first, there are reports today that U.S. intelligence officers warned India that an attack in Mumbai by seaborne terrorists was likely. Have you heard anything about this?
Yeah, it's quite an extraordinary series of events, actually, which has come out since the attacks came to an end, or since the siege at the two hotels, the Taj Mahal and the Oberoi, came to an end. Day by day, more information appearing about the kind of intelligence that was out there. There was, it seems, a warning from U.S. intelligence more than a month before the attacks that a seaborne attack on Mumbai was a possibility and that hotels could be a target. And then Indian intelligence, just 8 days before the attacks took place, intercepted a satellite telephone conversation in which targets in Mumbai were discussed. So there's no question that among all the intelligence chatter, some of this information was there. And I think a lot of the anger in India at the moment, especially among ordinary people, is why that information wasn't filtered out and dealt with appropriately.
How did the Indian government deal with it?
Well, it depends who you talk to. I think most ordinary Indians think they dealt with it pretty badly because they look at an intelligence and a police coordination which just isn't there. I mean, there are state police cells, there are state intelligence cells, there's a national intelligence unit, there are national police. And the problem is they don't really talk to each other much and they're under-resourced. One senior official told me a couple of days ago, look, we haven't really updated our system since independence, and that's 60 years ago. So this is a system that's in urgent need of repair. And I know hindsight's a wonderful thing, but a lot of people who deal with intelligence matters say, you know, this was a disaster waiting to happen.
So what is the latest on how Indian officials are viewing the attackers and their possible relationship to the Pakistani government or other groups in Pakistan?
Well, I think that's the critical thing. What relation do they really have to official elements in Pakistan? The Indians are under no doubt that these guys were Pakistanis. They have one, as you know, still alive in custody, a young man called Azam Amir Kassab, who they say is from Pakistani Punjab. I think they have a whole lot of evidence about why they believe all these men are from Pakistan, the fact that they came by boat from the Pakistani port of Karachi. I think they're going to want to present that to Secretary Rice, so to back up When she speaks in public about Pakistan having to cooperate, the Indians want her to have seen their intelligence, the information they've gathered, to give added weight to her calls for Pakistan to really do something. Not just to say out loud, we sympathize, we're going to cooperate, but actually to take action. And I think there's a lot of skepticism here that Pakistan intends to do any such sort of thing.
Is there any way in which multiple nations can cooperate on trying to crack down globally on Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is this group that has emerged and now is getting enormous coverage in South Asia and around the world?
Well, you know, one of the things which Secretary Rice mentioned in her first press conference here, she's going to be holding another one later in the day, was the need to crack down on the funding of militant groups. She says, you know, the amount of work we've done since 9/11 on chasing the funding, how people are paid for, it's incredibly important. And that, I guess, would be one way. But, you know, Lashkar-e-Taiba is well embedded in parts of Pakistan, just as we know as elements linked to Al-Qaeda, as the Taliban are. It's not going to be easy to simply wipe them out. And I think for the Pakistani authorities, the question is, is there a rogue element within the Pakistani state that has links with Lashkar-e-Taiba, or do they have much more formal links? And if those formal links are there, that's what India says must come to an end.
Very quickly, is Secretary Rice planning to visit Pakistan?
It's a possibility. As you know, the Secretary's schedule isn't always announced entirely in advance. But it's interesting. Today, as she arrived here, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, arrived in Islamabad. And I think that gives an indication of just how critically the U.S. views the India-Pakistan relationship at the moment. There are senior officials arriving in these two countries day by day.
Chris Morris, South Asia correspondent for the BBC, giving us the latest on Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice's visit to India. Thank you, Chris.
So we've been asking for your stories about multiple careers as part of our underemployment series. Terry on our website says, through the years, I've been a teacher, a writer, an artist, a photographer, a graphic designer, a chef, multimedia manager. Today, I am in graduate school, still trying to keep myself interesting to future employers. I've always been proud of the variety, but often found others did not like my multi-career track. As someone who has studied history, I'm all for the Renaissance man or woman a la Da Vinci. Tell us your slash story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. And now our newsreader slash Renaissance woman, Femi Oke, is here.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. So how much was your allowance as a kid, John, Adora?
I didn't have one. My parents didn't believe it.
I don't know, like $10 or $15 a week.
What? You were really rich. That's incredible. How about $1 for the entire year? That's how much the CEOs of Ford and GM say their salaries will be.
I think you set me up for that one, Femi.
$15? You are wealthy. No wonder you have so many shoes. Anyway, and the CEOs of Ford and GM say their salaries will be $1 a year if Congress approves a new bailout for the auto industry. It's part of the concessions they're making in their turn to try and get that bailout from Congress. A former prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay has spoken out against the way detainees are tried there. Daryl Vanderveld left his post at Guantanamo in September. He says the military commissions were at odds with the Constitution. The Pentagon says the system provides full and fair trials to those charged. And more than 100 countries are signing on to a new treaty banning cluster bombs. The US, China and Russia won't be signing on to the treaty. That's a look at some headlines making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi. You might be in trouble about the shoes.
She does have a lot of shoes.
Yeah.
$15. That was a lot back in the 70s.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
When unemployment figures are announced at the end of the week, there'll be more evidence that we're becoming a nation of part-timers or underemployed people. Tell us your slash.
Hi, my name is Jen from Brooklyn, and during the week, I am a museum collections cataloger, and on the weekends, I sing bluegrass and country music wherever I can.
Tell us your slash. Are you the carpet installer slash butcher? Are you a furniture deliverer in the morning and a pizza deliverer at night? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've heard some very interesting responses to this economic downturn. And here's another one. We're here with Eric Krangel, who was once on the cutting edge because Reuters, the news agency, came up to you and asked you to be a correspondent in Second Life, the virtual online world. Now, if you don't know what Second Life is, it's that world where people become avatars and they interact in this graphic environment on computer screens. Looks real enough, but it is a Second Life. So when Reuters said, Eric, we want you to be our correspondent in Second Life, you said?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's the most fun beat there is in journalism. Can't beat that.
And you imagined that you would be covering what?
Well, you know, we were Reuters, so we weren't so much in there just to sort of, you know, hang out and look around and
see what's
cool.
Come
well, on. We were a little bit. I was there for that. But in terms of our journalism, I mean, we were talking about it from a business standpoint. You know, is this a technology that's really taking off? Is it going to become the future of the web? Who's making money in there? Because at the time Reuters went in there, we saw all sorts of, you know, high-profile brands like Sony BMG, American Apparel. Everyone was rushing into Second Life to set up corporate presences. And that's what we were tracking. Were these presences working or were they not?
And a lot of my friends in advertising were running in there doing BMW and those kinds of things. So you discovered that the answer to a lot of those questions was no. And the answer to the question of, hey, am I on the cutting edge, Eric Krangel, the answer was, well, no, maybe not. So what happened to you ultimately?
Well, eventually Reuters shut down its Second Life Bureau. You know, it was an interesting phenomenon because there I was, you know, talking, you know, as a real life brand working for Reuters
right.
in Second Life. And so, first of all, a lot of my early stories were companies pulling out of Second Life.
Right.
And eventually, as I started to look more and more in terms of seeing how are brands using Second Life, what are Second Life's capabilities for business, the guy in there using it for business was me,
right.
which was an interesting
you
phenomenon.
You became the story.
Not exactly what you had anticipated. In fact,
no,
you're
wasn't.
Quite brutal, although you say that you're not surprised at all that your job was pulled. Because it doesn't make any sense, but also list the other reasons why you think Second Life actually is not such a perfect model as many thought in the beginning.
Well, I don't want to say that I'm brutal, and actually I'm really quite fond of Second Life. And, you know, if you hang out in Second Life for a little bit, you know, it's really a fantastic community of people. I mean, people there, you know, it's a community in the sense that MySpace or Facebook or a lot of other online communities are not. People have a real sense of togetherness, so I don't want to be overly harsh.
But it's a niche community other than a mass community. And I think the BMWs of the world were betting this was going to be the next big thing, and in fact, it's a small thing for a lot of interesting aficionados.
Sure, I'd agree with that completely, John. I mean, one of the things that was really interesting about Second Life, and, you know, as a reporter looking at the numbers, I'd always, you know, try to figure out, you know, is Second Life growing? How's it growing? And one thing I kept noticing the more and more time I spent in Second Life is that total hours kept going up, 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 up. But if you took a look at the number of accounts, the number of new registrations, flat.
That was plateauing.
So, you know, what you started to see was your real hardcore users, the people that get Second Life, the people that Second Life appeals to, the people that like it. I mean, for them, it's the most wonderful, amazing thing in the world. They want to spend all their time there. All their friends are there. Their social circles, their parties. That's what they do. And it's just insanely addictive. But for a general audience, it's really you know, not necessarily, it doesn't always click.
And so a general service news organization like Reuters has less use for that kind of a community than something that's, you know, poised to become a big mass media phenomenon. You are now working as a staff writer with Silicon Alley Insider.
That's
Do
right.
you think the decline as you observed it in Second Life was some kind of leading indicator of what we're experiencing more broadly in the economy now?
I wouldn't say so. I mean, Second Life is really kind of a special case that defies all rules. It exists in its own world, quite literally. I think what we saw with Second Life was, you know, when it came out really over 5 years ago, it was 3D. You could go in, you could walk around, and everyone thought, you know, is this the next web? Because, you know, 10 years ago, you know, even the web was new. And what I think we grew to learn was that Second Life has a real appeal for a certain number of people, but it's not necessarily the next web, not yet. In, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years, when the technology gets better, that's something that maybe we could look into.
But is the experience of Second Life, does that inform what the new web will be?
Quite possibly. You know, one of the interesting things about Second Life is I would sort of compare it in a way almost to CompuServe in the 1980s. I mean, when you look at CompuServe, you had email, you had bulletin boards, you had chat rooms, you had personals and people meeting each other and getting married from meeting each other on CompuServe. Of course, CompuServe, you know, even though it had all of these features of the internet, it was too early, it was too niche, it was too, in a word, geeky. And even though the internet, you know, had a lot of these same features, 10, 15 years later, when AOL and other companies sort of made it for the every man and every woman, CompuServe remained sort of a little community.
And it was cannibalized. Its features were cannibalized for the mass audience, even though it remained as a small community.
Sure, and it wouldn't surprise me to see maybe, 10 or 15 years from now, a lot of the Second Life type experiences, being in 3D, being able to make your own content, reach a more general audience. But I'm not sure if Second Life right now, if the technology is really there, if the usability is there. It's not. It's really pretty difficult for a lot of people to get into. It takes a lot of technical expertise. The software can be difficult to learn how to use.
And if a lot of users are using it, the thing crashes a lot. Eric, is it Krangle?
Yes, it is.
Krangle, yeah. And can I ask you one question about your avatar?
Anything.
Your avatar looks nothing like you. And, is really quite hot and has some very dreamy eyes there.
So you're saying that I'm not hot and I don't have dreamy eyes, John?
Not as hot as your avatar.
That's the meanest thing I've ever heard.
Do you miss your avatar, Eric?
Oh, thank you.
Do you miss being your avatar?
I do miss my avatar, and I still go into Second Life. I mean, I have a lot of friends there. There's great people.
Eric Krangle, former correspondent for the Reuters news agency in Second Life. He's currently a staff writer with Silicon Alley Insider. And now Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
20 minutes to the top of the hour, just coming up to that. Asian markets largely closed up. European markets are moving and have largely been down today. The Dow was down about 120 points in the last couple of minutes or so. For the first time, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has acknowledged that tumbling oil prices is hurting their country's economy. He says that the government will be forced to trim spending and raise taxes. The increasingly unpopular president is seeking re-election in June, and oil prices hit a three-year low yesterday. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in New Delhi. She's there to express her condolences for last week's terrorist attacks in Mumbai. And Secretary Rice said this morning that stopping terrorism is a priority and actually more important than finding the terrorist who attacked Mumbai. Meanwhile, in Mumbai, police say that they found and defused a bag full of explosives in the main train station. They say that they were left over from last week's attacks, and this news coming in from Associated Press. The train station was one of the first targets of the terrorists, and Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is actually in place to discuss details of that, plus the relationship between India and Pakistan that has deteriorated over the last few days. And finally, former First Lady Barbara Bush is feeling much better, and that's according to her husband. She underwent surgery for a stomach ulcer last week, and Barbara Bush was discharged from a Houston hospital yesterday. And that's a look at your news for now.
First Lady / patient. Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And John, as we've been talking about, all eyes are on the auto industry this week, and it's bid for a bailout on Capitol Hill. But remember, just 6 months ago, it was the airline industry that was in danger of tanking. Fuel prices, though, have since plunged, which should have helped lower ticket prices and help the industry, but it hasn't done so. Dan Michaels, the European aviation editor for The Wall Street Journal, joins us now from Brussels. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You say the airline industry is in a, quote, crash position. Explain that.
Well, the industry was preparing earlier this year for sky-high fuel prices and their costs going through the roof. So they grounded planes and cut capacity and were prepared for that crisis. Fuel prices then dropped, but at the same time, demand is plummeting. So they prepared for one crisis and are getting another. And that's why I'd say they're in crash position, because at least they're ready for something.
And the forecast is not good, as you've just explained. And there's lots of talk about possible mergers in order to save some of these airline companies. You want to tell us about the likely ones?
Sure. First, you got to understand that airline mergers across borders between two countries are really difficult, because airlines are kind of tied down by a global web of treaties between governments that say that an airline has to be owned by citizens of its country. So foreigners can't take over a U.S. airline. Americans can't take over a European airline. Within Europe, the European Union has allowed takeover. So Air France took over KLM. Lufthansa from Germany took over Swiss. Now, within Europe, Ryanair, an Irish budget airline, wants to take over its Irish rival Aer Lingus. British Airways is in talks with Iberia from Spain. And just yesterday, British Airways announced that it and Qantas from Australia, which is very far from Europe, are also in talks. So British Airways is juggling merger negotiations in two directions. But Europe seems to be the place where airline mergers, especially across borders, are most on the front burner.
Is it a matter of survival, Dan? And do you think any of these airlines will actually merge?
Some are, actually. Some small airlines, for example, right here in Belgium, Brussels Airlines has thrown itself in the arms of Germany's Lufthansa, which is much bigger and much richer. And for Brussels Airlines, it was a matter of survival. Austrian Airlines also is talking to Lufthansa about being bought out, and Austrian is in deep trouble. British Midland, a smaller British airline, is also being bought out by Lufthansa. So Lufthansa, which is big and rich, is buying up lots of smaller carriers that are faced with extinction. For some of the bigger ones like British Airways and Iberia, it's more a question of just getting heft and being able to compete better on the global stage.
So quickly, 20 seconds, what would you predict happening, let's say, in the next 6 or 8 months?
Probably more consolidation in Europe, maybe a bit with places like Australia. Not so much with the U.S. because the U.S. still has very strict limits on foreign ownership. So there might be some marketing tie-ups, but unlikely any mergers with U.S. carriers and foreign carriers.
Dan Michaels, we appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Dan Michaels is the European aviation editor for the Wall Street Journal, and he is predicting more mergers between and among airlines.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, December 3rd. Femi Oge has just joined us with the headlines of the hour. Femi.
Thank you very much. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. A huge win in a Georgia runoff race has Republicans cheering this morning. Incumbent Senator Saxby Chambliss crushed Democrat Jim Martin by a double-digit margin. President-elect Obama's cabinet is set to get a new member later this morning. Bill Richardson is on tap to get the Commerce Secretary nomination. The big three automaker CEOs will be on Capitol Hill later this week, and this time they brought detailed plans on how they use tens of billions in taxpayer dollars. Now all three CEOs have pledged to take a $1 a year salary, and Ford's communications director Mark Truby says that taking the salary cut is not a gimmick.
Now, in terms of Alan Mulally agreeing to work for $1 a year if we access the government loans, you know, I think the point he's making is that this is a time for shared sacrifice.
Now, lawmakers are reviewing the carmakers' proposals for fixing their businesses. And finally, tributes are coming in for a singer known simply as Odetta.
Oh, well, it's blues. Blues everywhere.
That's Odetta Holmes singing Blues Everywhere I Go. Odetta trained as a classical singer before discovering folk, blues, and gospel. She championed African-American music and civil rights issues and is credited for leading the folk revival of the 1950s. Odetta died Tuesday in New York from heart disease, age 77.
Well, it's blues in my house, from my bedroom down to the ground.
Odetta says it all. Thank you, Femi. We are becoming a nation of part-timers. All week we are looking at the changing labor force. Tell us your slash.
I am Denise calling from New Jersey. I am a cashier. I am an optician. And I am a crossing guard. And the cashier job is actually like a sociology experiment because you're really get to learn about people in that job.
That's great. We are learning about people in this underemployment series all week. Are you a registered nurse slash clown? Have you moved into two or more part-time careers? Tell us your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org. Great, great stuff from our listeners, of course. Now, between now and inauguration, we're also taking a look at something we're calling, for lack of a better name, low-hanging change fruit, the kind of things that are left over from the Cold War or maybe the mid-20th century or even the 19th century. Could these become opportunities for change and change in policy for the new administration of Barack Obama? And one of the places where change may be possible is the relationship between Cuba and the United States. And there is an amazing story in the New York Times Magazine this weekend that everyone should check out. It's written by New York Times columnist Roger Cohen, who joins us from the Netherlands this morning. Roger, thanks so much for being a part of the program.
Pleasure.
I have to say that, you know, you've spent a lot of time covering Cold War landmarks in your experience as a reporter for The Times. Your report and this really portrait of Cuba at a moment of change that's in the New York Times magazine is really, really vivid. I'm wondering if you just have a sense of how psychologically prepared the people of Cuba are for something big happening over the next 4 years. Let's not even talk about what that might be.
Well, you know, I think they've been worn down over 50 years in January of Fidel Castro's revolution. There's a lot of economic depression and inertia there. So I think Cubans, with a few exceptions, have almost given up on the prospect of radical change. But I think that could itself evolve fairly quickly, because a lot of the conditions are there for something dramatic to happen, including the fact that Fidel at 82 is fading away. The generations of Cuban Americans who've been most radical and hardline in their attitude to the regime in Cuba are now changing that view. And you have Obama coming in and saying, look, as you said, this is low-hanging change fruit, and he wants to see some changes, has already indicated that he's going to make some changes in policy.
Well, one of the great things about your article, and it's called The End of the End of the Revolution, I urge people to take a look at it this weekend, is how Cubans love to psychoanalyze the U.S. resistance to change as far as the U.S.-Cuban relationship is. Tell us some stories of people you met who love to psychoanalyze the U.S.
Well, you know, the first thing to say is that Cubans spend a lot of time hanging around talking. They have nothing else to do. In my piece, I focus on one street called Lealtad Street, Loyalty Street, and a few stores that distribute these ration goods like chicken, eggs, rice, flour. And when those goods aren't there, there's nothing for the people manning these stores to do. So they sit around talking, and they will say, well, yeah, this system is bad, but look in the U.S., look at the financial crisis you have. And it has to be said that one of the very few places on earth that has not been affected by the financial meltdown is Cuba. And on the other hand, then somebody will come and say, well, look, but how many of the more than a million Cubans who've left have ever wanted to come back from the United States? So on the one hand, you have a view of the U.S. as having a system that Fidel has relentlessly portrayed as an evil capitalist system. On the other, you have the awareness that this kind of museum, this haunting, beautiful, strange, alternately depressing and uplifting museum that Fidel has created, along with these 50-year-old motor vehicles and 50-year-old appliances in people's homes. You know, people are still hoping they might get toasters in 2010. You know, they realize that has to change, that Cuba has to move toward the world. At the same time, there's ambivalence about whether it really wants to embrace a capitalist model or stick with something in between.
That was, as John said, a very vivid moment in your article. There was no response when that person said, well, how many Cubans have come back? You certainly came across people, though, who defiantly back the revolution and say it was the right thing for Cuba.
Well, there have been achievements. There is no denying this. Life expectancy in Cuba is the same as in the United States. It's over 80 years for women and in the high 70s for men. And this is much, much better than anywhere else in the Caribbean. The education system is good. More than 90% of Cuban kids finish high school. And one of the great ironies and frustrations of the system is that why educate people to such a level and then not give them the opportunity to employ those skills? Cuba is in one of its newer ventures where it once sent mercenaries to or guerrilla fighters, let's say, to Angola. It now sends doctors to Venezuela by the thousand, and in exchange for these doctors, it gets 90,000 barrels of oil a day at heavily discounted rates. So there are achievements, there's no question about that, but I think the revolution has reached a kind of a dead end. You know, Cuba is stuck in time, and an awful lot of talented people are sticking around there wanting to get out and essentially doing nothing. Well, so there's a lot of wasted talent
in Cuba. The portrait of the streets of Havana and the places around Cuba that emerge in your piece really describe the pressure on both sides, both the U.S. and in Cuba, for some kind of change to take place and for this waste to stop. I love particularly the sort of four-tiered currency system you talk about. I don't know if we have time to get into the details there. It's so labor-intensive to just be a consumer in Cuba. But one of the great characters in your piece said this. He's 71 years old, and I know I'll see the day, Duran told you, the day when you can get in your speedboat in Coconut Grove in Florida after work and be in Havana at 9 p.m. for dinner. Do you believe that that is true? That will happen in his lifetime?
I think it could. You know, one of the hallucinogenic things about Cuba, and there are many, is that, you know, you hop in a Beechcraft turboprop, as I did in Miami, and it's 90 miles away. You know, in 45 minutes you're there, and you're there in this world that has nothing to do with anywhere else, and particularly with the United States. Look, what has Obama done already? He said he's going to free up visits to the island for relatives of families there. He's going to lift, he's going to remove any limits on the remittances that go in. He has said that in the right circumstances, he'd be prepared to meet eventually with Raul Castro, Fidel's brother, who is now formerly the president, although Fidel still has Cubans totally in his thrall.
Well, what does
I think we could go further, you know, and offer diplomatic relations to Cuba, and let's see how they respond. There are still things going on in Cuba, like the number of political prisoners still in jail, that are totally unacceptable. We need to try and use the leverage of the embargo to get them out.
Well,
ripe for change.
Well, everyone's anticipating that moment. Roger Cohn, I could listen to you all day. He's a New York Times columnist joining us from The Hague. His article in the magazine on Sunday, The End of the Revolution, is about Cuba. Thanks, Roger.
Fascinating article. But here at The Takeaway, we're asking you the question, have we become a nation of part-timers?
Hi, this is Joe from Teaneck, New Jersey, and I'm currently a father. Did I mention father? A musician, too.
That's a thankless job. Here's another one.
I'm Sam, and I'm a teacher / art administrator / single dad.
We want to hear your stories, right? Fascinating stories.
Your slashes.
As we take a look at the changing labor force, tell us your slash story, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.